had enough of those supplements that leave you feeling nothing? Symbiotica is your solution to great-tasting, all-natural supplements that actually work. Crafted with premium plant-based ingredients, their products have no seed oils, fillers, or artificial nonsense. It's just pure goodness in every pouch. Try them out and actually feel the difference today. Visit Symbiotica.com and use code IHEART for 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Again, that's 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Go to Symbiotica.com. That's Symbiotica.com.
With the new Dexcom G7, you can achieve better diabetes results without painful fingersticks. It sends your glucose numbers to your compatible phone or watch so you can always see where you are and where you're heading. See how food and exercise affects your glucose, making it easier to spend more time in range and lower your A1C. Take more control of your diabetes with the number one recommended CGM brand. It's easy to get started today at Dexcom.com. That's Dexcom.com.
Dexcom data on file 2023. If your glucose alerts and readings from the G7 do not match symptoms or expectations, use a blood glucose meter to make diabetes treatment decisions. For a list of compatible devices, visit Dexcom.com/compatibility.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
You can get a sense of what the world was like in 1967 by looking at the covers of Time magazine from that year. There's Chairman Mao, the communist leader of the People's Republic of China, whose cultural revolution had plunged his country into chaos. General William Westmoreland, commander of U.S. forces in Vietnam, confident of victory in a war that was becoming more and more unpopular. Sandy Dennis, whose performance in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf won her an Oscar, and newlyweds Margaret Rusk and Guy Smith. Okay, I'm pretty sure you don't recognize those names. Margaret, better known as Peggy, was the daughter of then-Secretary of State Dean Rusk, Guy Smith, her longtime love. So why were they on the September 29th, 1967 cover of Time? For the simple reason that Peggy was white, and Guy was black. The headline reads, "Mr. and Mrs. Guy Smith, an interracial marriage."
Margaret Elizabeth Rusk, only daughter of Secretary of State Dean Rusk, becomes the wife of Air Force Reserve Lieutenant Guy Gibson Smith, a Negro.
1967, it turned out, was a very big year for interracial marriage.
In all the field of race relations, probably nothing is more sensitive than the issue of intermarriage.
That June, in the landmark ruling of Loving versus Virginia, the Supreme Court struck down state laws banning it in the United States. Mildred and Richard Loving had actually gone to jail after getting married.
We were in it because we got married. We loved each other and got married.
The court's decision was unanimous, but only a fifth of Americans actually approved of interracial marriage, an attitude that Hollywood was about to address with a major motion picture.
Three Academy Award winners and a bright young newcomer combine their talents in a love story of today.
In December, the movie Guess Who's Coming to Dinner starred Sidney Poitier as a black doctor planning to marry a white woman and delivering the news to his future in-laws, played by Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy.
Mrs. Drayton, I'm medically qualified, so I hope you wouldn't think it presumptuous if I say you ought to sit down before you fall down, I mean.
He thinks you're gonna faint because he's a Negro.
Well, I don't think I'm going to faint.
In the middle of all of this, a very private couple thrust into the spotlight.
Miss Rusk and Mr. Smith had obviously thought long and hard about the consequences of a mixed marriage.
But Peggy Rusk Smith says she and her husband had only one focus as they walked down the aisle.
We didn't get married for any reason other than the fact that we loved each other. We weren't trying to prove anything, change anything. Sorry to be so boring, but that's the truth of it.
But the story of her and her late husband is anything but boring. It involves romance in turbulent times, presidents, movie stars, and horses. We'll hear that story, and along the way, look back at the surprising history of interracial relationships in the United States. From CBS Sunday Morning and iHeart, I'm Mo Rocca, and this is Mobituaries. This Mobit, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, and the year that changed marriage in America.
You know, I'll tell you a funny story about the dress. I've had it cleaned and boxed and sealed, so it's still in good shape from when I wore it. So I thought, well, maybe I should give it to a thrift shop. And well, whoever I was speaking to said, why don't you see if the Smithsonian wants it? And I said, oh, please. But to make them happy, I called them. And to my shock, the Smithsonian does want it.
Peggy, of course they want it. This was a big deal.
I'm going to give it to you straight. Peggy Rusk is not the type of person I'm used to interviewing. She's the opposite of a hype artist. But don't be fooled. Her story was remarkable for its time. So let's go back to 1961, when Peggy was 11 and her father became Secretary of State under President John F. Kennedy.
Why did he accept the job?
Because he was asked. The president asked him, and he believed if the president asked you to do something, you do it.
To serve your country.
Yes. He didn't want to, but he was asked.
The Rusk family quickly transitioned from a quiet life in Scarsdale, New York, to a busy life of politics and diplomacy in Washington, D.C. As the daughter of America's top diplomat, Peggy accompanied her mother to receptions at various embassies.
So I got used to seeing people from all over the world, all different nationalities and ethnicities and different language, different dress. Difference was normal to me.
It was an exciting, but also kind of a lonely time.
My parents were gone all the time. It was very rare for them to be home.
She threw herself into one of her early loves, horseback riding, at Washington's Rock Creek Park. And it was there, at age 14, that she found another love, Guy Smith. A riding instructor at the stables, Guy had grown up in Washington, the only child of an analyst working at the Pentagon and a teacher.
And what was it about him, just from his appearance, that immediately made you go, whoa?
He was cute, what can I say? And very sweet. A gentleman. And friendly. Open.
A few years older.
5 years older.
5 years older.
The age difference didn't seem to faze Peggy. She emphasizes that their relationship began very much as a friendship. In fact, she saw a number of similarities between Guy's family and her own.
His mother and father were wonderful, wonderful people. Very smart, well-educated. Their house was full of books and full of classical music. My father and Guy's father were like bookends.
Guy's parents had sent him to the progressive Georgetown Day School, integrated at its founding in 1945, when D.C.'s public schools were still segregated. Guy would go on to attend Georgetown University. But Peggy also acknowledges how race made their experiences very different. Guy had to travel a good distance from his predominantly black neighborhood of LaDroit Park just to get to the stables each day.
It's sad because as our home in Spring Valley was appreciating, their home where they lived on the other side of the city was depreciating.
And they couldn't just live anywhere.
No. They couldn't buy anywhere. And probably places wouldn't rent to them, too.
Another difference between the two, where they stood politically.
Well, Guy was a conservative. He voted for Goldwater.
Guy was a conservative Republican.
Right, and I was a liberal Democrat. But back then, politics did not color your life the way
it does now.
For some people now.
Things would eventually progress between the two at where else? A horse show. The show had a pairs event where two riders would compete together.
And Guy had come at the showgrounds and asked me if I would pair with him.
Well, that must have been exciting.
It was exciting. I was like, yes, sure.
But when Guy suddenly had to pair with another girl in the competition, Peggy was crushed.
And I left the Showgrounds and started riding. This is really a young mind at work. I was going to ride until it got dark, have them all worried about what happened, especially him, worry about what had happened to me.
Yes, yes.
You know, so this is my payback.
You would go missing.
I would go missing, yes.
And he would feel guilty.
Yes, exactly.
It was a great plan, but unfortunately, nobody seemed to realize Peggy was missing.
So I decided, okay, it was time to go back to the barn.
Right.
It was totally dark.
But no one was there.
I thought, what? They've all come home and not even noticed that I wasn't back there with a horse, and they all left, and nobody gives up. You know what? I took the horse down, put him in the stall, and was brushing him with the tears rolling down my face.
I can see it.
Yes. Feeling completely unloved by every soul.
When who should appear?
So I'm in the corner stall, and I hear footsteps down coming down the cement aisleway. And, you know, I'm going like this, trying to clean my face.
Wiping your tears.
Wiping my tears
away.
He
can't see that you've been crying.
Right. And he gets to the edge of the stall, and he said, would you like a ride home? Sure, you know.
This suddenly has gotten great.
Yes, really great. Whew. Even better. On the way home, he invited me to go to the horse show dinner banquet with him.
Did you recognize that he was asking?
Yes.
He was asking you on a date.
Yes. Well, to go to the banquet.
The date?
Okay. Yes.
But before the two would set out on their date, Guy felt it was important to get permission from Peggy's mother.
Was it just that he was very formal?
I think he was very polite and well-raised, but I also think he might have been smart enough to realize that if he showed himself in person to my mother, if there was an issue with the race, she could just say, no, she can't go. And the race issue wouldn't come up.
This way, there would be no surprises.
Right.
Your mother would know that she was saying yes to you going to a banquet with a black man.
I thought it was brilliant.
Yeah.
In retrospect.
Now remember, it's 1963, the year before the Civil Rights Act of 1964, when former President Harry Truman, the man who had signed the executive order integrating the armed forces, was asked by reporters about his thoughts on intermarriage. He replied that he didn't believe in it. So it wouldn't have been shocking if Peggy's parents took issue with their daughter dating an African-American.
Was Guy's race ever discussed by you and your parents? It must have been at some point.
Never.
Peggy's parents, she says, were different, particularly her dad, which is kind of surprising. Dean Rusk was a Southern Democrat from Cherokee County, Georgia, the grandson of Confederate soldiers. As a young boy, he delivered groceries to white families and the black families who lived literally on the other side of the tracks.
When he would deliver to the black families, everybody would be sitting outside on the steps because it was hot. And Pop said he would sit on the steps and listen to them talk and realize that what they said was completely different than what black people would say when they were around white people.
Looking back, Rusk would remember that he, quote, heard their anger and learned of their hopes. And even at age 8, quote, I could sense the unfairness of it all. As he grew up, he quietly took a stand against racial intolerance. In 1942, while serving in the War Department's Military Intelligence Office, he was meeting with Ralph Bunche, a young analyst who would go on to become a civil rights leader, a diplomat, and the first African-American to win the Nobel Peace Prize.
It was lunchtime, and Pop said, let's go to the cafeteria and get some lunch. And Mr. Bunche said, Dean, you know I can't go eat there. And Pop said, oh, yeah, we'll see about that. They just went, and from that day on, it's desegregated.
Now, as Secretary of State, Dean Rusk's unwavering support of American involvement in Vietnam is a permanent part of his legacy. It's in the first line of his New York Times obit. Rusk was on the wrong side of history on Vietnam. But what's been forgotten is his equally unstinting support of civil rights. It wasn't just a moral issue for him, it was also a foreign policy concern. He believed legalized segregation would keep the U.S. from winning the Cold War.
And this was the time when the African nations were being built.
Right, you know, they were decolonized.
Decolonized, right.
Right.
And so there were a lot of new African diplomats in Washington.
But the capital of the free world welcomed these dignitaries with less than open arms. In the early 1960s, D.C. remained largely segregated, if not legally, then in practice. Black diplomats were living and working there, yet often unable to find housing or be served in many restaurants. Again, these were diplomats. A Washington Post article from the time notes that D.C. was becoming a hardship post for these emissaries. The situation outside the city limits was even worse. For diplomats traveling by car between the nation's capital and the United Nations in New York City, the only route was along U.S. Highway 40, which passed for a stretch through Maryland, a state where businesses were still legally permitted to segregate customers or even refuse to serve. African diplomats found themselves ejected from restaurants or unable to use the bathroom. In 1961, the ambassador from the newly formed country of Chad was refused service as he tried to get a cup of coffee in a Maryland diner. The governor of Maryland apologized after the White House and Attorney General Robert Kennedy interceded. On a personal note, I find this little-known chapter of history particularly disturbing. I grew up in the 1970s in the Maryland suburbs outside D.C., the sauntering drive down Massachusetts Avenue, also known as Embassy Row, towards downtown is something I remember fondly. Passing one ornate embassy after another, trying to memorize the flags outside each one. The people who worked there were their country's representatives to America. I had no idea of what black African diplomats were subjected to only a decade earlier. The troubling and embarrassing situation was summed up in a powerful speech given by former CBS News anchor Edward R. Murrow back in May of 1961. Murrow had recently become director of the United States Information Agency, and he delivered a stark warning.
It is not only that these people are humans like the rest of us, but that they are leaders of their nations whose friendship this land deems vital. We would have them join our company of honorable men in defending against encroachment our dedication to dignity and freedom. But it is a dignity to which we will not fully admit them.
And in a nod to Cold War tensions, Murrow noted,
and let us remember, this is not something the communists did to us. We do it ourselves in our own capital. Is it possible that we concern ourselves too much with outer space and far places and too little with inner space and near places?
Rusk and the State Department knew that these discriminatory actions were damaging America's reputation overseas.
It was a huge problem for him as Secretary of State. I just think it showed the United States to be hypocritical and not willing to live up to its own Constitution and Bill of Rights.
Throwing his support behind the proposed Civil Rights Act, Dean Rusk testified in a Senate hearing in July of 1963, sparring with South Carolina Senator Strom Thurmond.
Do you favor the demonstrations that have been held? And would you favor demonstrations in the future if this Civil Rights Bill does not pass?
Well, Senator, there are various types of demonstration. I would not wish to make a blanket statement about all those that I've known about, but I would say this, sir. If I were denied what our Negro citizens denied, I would demonstrate.
Meanwhile, his daughter's boyfriend was experiencing discrimination firsthand.
We were stopped at times by the police.
In D.C.?
In D.C. And they would make Guy get out, make us both get out, and they would take forever searching the car looking for a reason to arrest him or to fine him or do whatever. And I could see Guy being, having to hold his temper. And it was an uncomfortable time.
Were you ever tempted to say, I'm the daughter of the Secretary of State? Because that would have been
incredible. I kept my mouth shut.
Okay.
But it was not comfortable.
It made Guy angry? Was it
yes.
Was it humiliating?
I know it made him angry because I could see it in his eyes. I don't know if humiliating is the right word. I think people of color back then, when they were unjustly treated, were more angry than humiliated.
In spite of the issues they faced, Peggy also acknowledges that Guy's physical appearance was likely a factor in some people being more accepting of the relationship.
I'm sure that it made it easier in ways that he was light-skinned.
After dating for several years, Peggy and Guy decided they wanted to get hitched. It was Christmas of 1966 when Peggy, home from her freshman year at Stanford, told her parents she would be getting married the following year.
He was going to be going off to Vietnam, and I would be 18. And we didn't ask for my parents' permission. We just said, we're going to get married in September. Just like that.
But they had no idea how big a deal this wedding would be, or that 1967 would prove to be a game-changing year for interracial marriage.
After all, an awful lot of people are going to think that we're a very shocking pair. Isn't that right, Mrs. Drayton?
I know what you mean.
Had enough of those supplements that leave you feeling nothing? Symbionica is your solution to great-tasting, all-natural supplements that actually work. Crafted with premium plant-based ingredients, their products have no seed oils, fillers, or toxins. Try them out and actually feel the difference today. Visit Symbionica.com and use code IHEART for 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Again, that's 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Go to Symbionica.com. C-Y-M-B-I-O. T-I-K-A.com.
You're a growing business, which means you need every spare hour you can find. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
I get that history doesn't move in a straight line, but the history of interracial relationships in this country really moves in zigs and zags, with a number of famous and not-so-famous names. We're going to get to Peggy and Guy's wedding day in a bit, but I wanted to go back further in time to really explore how we got to 1967. Is this a story that begins and ends in Virginia?
Yeah, absolutely. It does.
That's Cheryl Cashin. She's a Georgetown University law professor and the author of Loving, Interracial Intimacy and the Threat to White Supremacy. She says interracial relationships began in the earliest years of the Virginia colony. At the time, she writes, there were legal unions between white people and Black people like Tony Longo.
Tony Longo was a very skilled cattleman when he arrived as a kidnapped enslaved person. By 1652, he owned 250 acres of land in the colony.
In the Jamestown colony, Cashin says, some enslaved Black people were able to hire themselves out and buy their freedom. For a time, they were then able to vote, bear arms, and marry, which is what Tony Longo eventually did, marrying a white English woman after obtaining his freedom.
And he wasn't the only one. There was no prohibition against interracial marriage at that time.
Were they living their lives fairly openly? Do we know?
Yes. It was not illegal. So this marriage, which was legally sanctioned, underscores that at least among the working class people, there wasn't this strict separation. And, you know, there was actually a lot of interracial cooperation, particularly around resistance to masters.
Fearful of free Black people and white indentured servants coming together and rebelling, new laws were created to enforce separation, denying Black people first the right to bear arms, then the right to vote. By 1691, interracial marriage was illegal in Virginia. Other colonies and eventually states would enact similar laws. Still, interracial relationships were happening. Okay, quick note. I'm using the word relationship to describe how two individuals related to each other, not to imply consent. You probably know the story of Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, which by most accounts was non-consensual. After all, she was enslaved by Jefferson at Monticello. But Cheryl Cashin writes about a relationship between another slaveholding white politician and a Black woman that she describes differently.
I consider myself a presidential history buff, but clearly I need to bone up on my vice presidential history because I had no idea that Martin Van Buren's vice president, Richard Mentor Johnson, had an interracial relationship that you describe as sort of a common law marriage.
Richard Mentor Johnson actually was one of the best known politicians of his era.
And Johnson became the center of national attention during the election of 1836, when the public became aware of his common law marriage with Julia Chin, a mixed-race woman enslaved by his family. Johnson, from Kentucky, had two daughters with Chin and publicly recognized them as his own. The daughters lived their lives as free women, both marrying white men.
People were scandalous. What was shocking was that he was bringing this out into the open and trying to have it legitimated because he genuinely loved this woman.
Johnson defended his marriage as, quote, under the eyes of God. While he was serving in Congress, Julia Chin died.
What really scandalized people about this man is that he continued to take up with Black women he enslaved. I guess he had a thing about that.
Southern newspapers denounced Richard Mentor Johnson as the great amalgamationist.
As far as I can tell, the relationship with Julia Chin was a benevolent, voluntary relationship, but his subsequent sex with other Black women, as far as I could tell, was rape. So I would use rapist, at least for these subsequent relationships.
Fast forward to the post-Civil War North and a figure who still looms large today.
The great writer, abolitionist, Frederick Douglass. I had no idea that he had married a white woman. Never knew this.
Really? You didn't know this?
Douglass, the child of a Black mother and white father, was married for over 40 years to Anna Murray Douglass, a free Black woman. But in 1884, a year and a half after Anna's death, he married a white suffragist named Helen Pitts in Philadelphia, where interracial marriage was legal.
Frederick Douglass emancipated himself not only from slavery, but from the social constrictions of race. He was the center of a biracial, abolitionist movement. That gave some opportunity to actually meet someone on equal terms and equal intellectual terms.
Douglas's marriage caused an uproar, and not just among white people. A black Washington, D.C. newspaper called it a national calamity. Black reformer and intellectual Booker T. Washington wrote, "His own race especially condemned him, and the notion seemed to be quite general that he had made the most serious mistake of his life."
Well, this is what happens. You know, you spend centuries teaching people to stay within lines and having rules that fortify a color line. It colors the practices of people on both sides of the line.
In a letter to a friend, Douglas defended his marriage, asking, "What business has the world with the color of my wife?"
So ahead of his time, you know, just to say, I am going to do what my heart tells me to do, and I'm going to exercise every discretion that freedom brings, including who I decide to marry and love.
While Frederick Douglass was able to marry someone of a different race in the late 1800s, that was certainly not the case everywhere. The post-Civil War era of Reconstruction had seen the end of some interracial marriage bans, but in most cases, only briefly. The doors would close again toward the end of the 19th century as Jim Crow laws went into effect in the South. In 1915, D.W. Griffith's landmark and deeply racist film, The Birth of a Nation, was released. In one of its more infamous scenes, an actor in blackface menaces a Southern white woman who leaps to her death rather than submit to him. This pernicious myth of the black man as a predator was being perpetuated, Cashin says, as a way of preventing the races from mixing.
From the beginning, that was a central part of the dogma around race and civil rights. You know, the fear that if we give any black freedom, your daughter's going to end up having sex with a black man, and how enduring and central the political debates around race were tied to this question of interracial marriage and interracial sex.
By the mid-20th century, attitudes had calcified, particularly, though not exclusively, in the South. In the late 1950s, only 4% of Americans approved of interracial marriage.
Once you put in place an institution that's animated by an ideology, here the ideology white supremacy, the ideology continues even after the institution slavery ends. Generation after generation is conscripted into this social order, which says you should not cross this line. So those habits continue. So it's very hard to disrupt something like that.
But disruption finally came in 1967, thanks to a couple named Richard and Mildred Loving.
The story that began years ago in the farmlands of Caroline County may provide the landmark decision on interracial marriage.
The two had grown up together in Central Point, a small town in Virginia with a long history of white and black residents mixing. Richard was white, Mildred part black, part Native American. The two married in 1958, traveling to Washington, D.C., where they could legally wed. After they took their vows, the Lovings went home to Virginia.
Mrs. Loving, tell me, what happened after you got married? When did you first get into trouble with the law?
We were married on the second day of June, and the police came after us the 14th of July. We were married a month and a few days.
The sheriff of Caroline County and his deputies burst into the Lovings' house in the middle of the night, arresting the couple in their bedroom.
Mrs. Loving, what has been the worst part about all this for you?
Well, I guess the worst thing that was spending a little time in jail, that's the worst thing.
The two were sentenced to a year in prison, but the sentences were suspended on the condition that they leave Virginia and not return together for 25 years. The Lovings began raising their family in Washington, D.C., But after several years, Mildred had had enough. She wanted to live in Virginia with her husband and their children and without fear. The ACLU took the Lovings case and began a legal battle that would go all the way to the Supreme Court in 1967.
You couldn't ask for a better case. The Lovings. You know, this is like something out of a movie, right? The Lovings.
In June of that year, the court decided in the Lovings' favor, a unanimous decision, ruling that the bans on interracial marriage, which still existed in 16 states, were unconstitutional.
These are not people who would want to be public figures, but it was their deep love for each other and just wanting the right to live in the community they love with the person they love that made them persevere.
And only 3 months later, Peggy Rusk and Guy Smith would walk down the aisle and onto a magazine cover.
Had enough of those supplements that leave you feeling nothing? Symbionica is your solution to great-tasting, all-natural supplements that actually work. Crafted with premium plant-based ingredients, their products have no seed oils, fillers, or toxins. Try them out and actually feel the difference today. Visit Symbionica.com and use code IHEART for 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Again, that's 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Go to Symbionica.com, C-Y-M-B-I-O-T-I-K-A.com.
You're a growing business, which means you need every spare hour you can find. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
The Loving versus Virginia case, were you following that at all?
No.
Were you even aware of it?
Vaguely.
So you didn't think this thing that's happening kind of applies to me?
It wouldn't have changed our minds. We were going to get married regardless.
As their wedding day approached, Peggy Rusk and Guy Smith had managed to stay under the radar, even as the country was debating the propriety and legality of interracial marriage.
A blessed privacy which lasted almost till the moment they walked out of the Stanford University chapel as man and wife.
On September 21st, 1967, Peggy Rusk and Guy Smith were married. Newsreels show the couple emerging from the chapel at Stanford with smiles on their faces.
I think some of the press coverage said that no one seemed less anxious than you and Guy, that you were utterly at ease.
We were, completely at ease.
But still, you're 18, you're walking out of a chapel, and there is a phalanx of press there. Did that set you back on your heels a little bit? You just went with it.
The wedding took place in front of about 60 guests, including the bride and groom's parents. But several of Dean Rusk's Georgia relatives refused to attend.
Was there disapproval from some members of the family?
I'm sure. Papa's told, don't ever show up at a family reunion again.
That's a pretty clear message.
If the condemnation of his relatives bothered him, Dean Rusk was not one to share.
Mr. Secretary, will we have your comments on the marriage?
Oh, very pleased, thank you.
But according to Peggy, her father was concerned that his daughter's marriage might create problems for President Johnson by risking crucial support from Southerners in Congress. And so, she says, he made a dramatic proposal of his own to the commander-in-chief.
My father went to President Johnson before we got married and offered his resignation. And Johnson said, forget it. You know, it didn't bother Johnson at all.
Did you know that your father had done that?
Not till afterwards.
And what did you think when you heard that?
It's like Pop to serve the man he's supposed to be serving and be honest with him about all things. So it was very much in character.
This was a very joyous wedding. There was no gloom. And I would go further and say that this may be a stride in the direction that we all need to be taking with this very difficult business of race relations and this area in particular.
That's Reverend B. Davy Napier, the dean of the Stanford Chapel who officiated Peggy and Guy's wedding, talking to CBS News. And he was right. There was a lot of joy, but there was also a lot of hate.
I showed up at Stanford on Monday after we got married. There were huge, big mail sacks of mail. You know, the big canvas sacks?
Sure.
Full of mail. We'd sit on the floor and we'd open letters and, it was pretty easy to tell which were positive, which were negative.
What was the ratio about?
About 75 negative to 25 positive. And the negatives were usually really thick and full of Bible
verses
and stuff like that.
Did any of the nasty mail scare you?
No.
Really? Did they include threats?
Oh, yeah.
Did you report any of those letters?
No. No.
Peggy and Guy took it all in stride, the bad with the good. And perhaps the most surprising moment of all, a week after the wedding, they realized they were on the cover of Time magazine.
Time magazine was a big deal back then. You're on the cover of it.
Yeah.
Did you know you were going to be on the cover
before? Oh, no.
So this hit newsstands and you went, that's me and my husband?
Remember in The Godfather when they're walking down the street and they see the headline of, what's his name, the main guy getting shot?
Right.
And they stop and go back and look like that. That was us with that magazine. We had no idea. And we're walking down the street and all of a sudden we see a newsstand. And it's like, you're kidding me.
Can I just tell you, by the way, I held my breath waiting for which scene in The Godfather you were going to cite. Thank goodness it wasn't the horse head.
No.
Did you immediately buy a copy and read it?
A copy. We probably bought 10.
They had captured the public's attention, so much so that when a major motion picture about interracial marriage premiered a few months later, the film would get an unexpected boost of publicity, thanks to the extensive coverage of Peggy and Guy's nuptials. As writer Mark Harris notes in his book Pictures at a Revolution, the wedding, quote, brought the subject of interracial marriage to the forefront of the national conversation about race. Or, as it was bluntly put by New York Post critic Archer Winston, the Dean Rusk family appears to have fronted for this very film.
You've got to give a little.
That film?
Little.
Guess Who's
and
Coming to Dinner?
Heartbreak a little.
With a star-studded cast of Spencer Tracy in his final movie role, Katharine Hepburn and Sidney Poitier, along with Hepburn's niece Katherine Houghton, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner was the story of a white liberal San Francisco couple forced to confront their own prejudices when their daughter comes home with the black man she intends to marry.
And it never occurred to me that I might fall in love with a Negro, but I did, and nothing in the world is going to change that. Even if you had any objections, I wouldn't let him go now if you were the governor of Alabama.
Guess Who's Coming to Dinner was filmed before the Loving versus Virginia decision came down. Hence, some of the references that had already fallen out of date.
Have you thought what people would say about you? Why, in 16 or 17 states, you'd be breaking the law. You'd be criminals. And say they changed the law. That don't change the way people feel about this thing.
The movie ends with a stirring speech by Spencer Tracy. It might seem a little hokey today, but it's still a powerful moment, especially given it was Tracy's last moment on screen. He would die just 17 days after filming.
I'm sure you know what you're up against. There'll be 100 million people right here in this country who will be shocked and offended and appalled at the two of you. And the two of you will just have to ride that out. Maybe every day for the rest of your lives. You can try to ignore those people, or you can feel sorry for them and for their prejudices and their bigotry and their blind hatreds and stupid fears. But where necessary, you'll just have to cling tight to each other and say, screw all those people.
Guess Who's Coming to Dinner was a big hit with audiences. In a little over a year, it was on Variety's list of all-time box office winners in the company of Gone with the Wind and The Sound of Music. The movie was an awards darling as well, getting nominated for 10 Oscars, including Best Picture, and winning a major acting award, coincidentally presented by Sidney Poitier.
The winner is Katharine Hepburn, and Guess Who's Coming to Dinner?
Which is not to say everyone loved it. Life magazine's film critic would call the movie an inescapably sentimental occasion. Another person who wasn't a fan, Peggy Rusk.
I saw the movie. I didn't relate to it. I thought they made too big a deal about the race thing. That wasn't how we felt at all. I was actually kind of bored.
There are some great performances in it.
I'm sure there are.
When Guy was deployed as a helicopter pilot to Vietnam after their wedding, he and Peggy wrote to each other every single day. Even after his return, if he was away for a few days, they would write each other. The letters are heartfelt and tender.
I love you with all my heart and consider myself the happiest and luckiest girl in the world. So, darling, I guess that's why I don't fall apart when you have to be away. It's because you are so much a part of my soul that even when you are 3,000 miles away, I still feel like you are within me. Take care, lover, and don't work too hard. I love you very, very much and can't wait to be in your arms again. Love, Peggy.
Guy and Peggy had a daughter, two grandchildren, and it seems a very happy life. The couple had been married for nearly 45 years when Guy died in 2012 at age 67. At the end, he was suffering from dementia.
Then he got to the point where he really couldn't recognize or do much of anything. But I was the one person that he still recognized.
He never stopped recognizing
me. He never stopped recognizing me.
Was he able to speak?
A little bit. And his last words, because he died at home in bed. I was holding him. And his last conscious words were to apologize for leaving me alone.
Peggy Rusk and Guy Smith became a part of our cultural history because of what people saw of their marriage from the outside, two people with different skin colors. But ultimately, this was a love story.
This story, which a lot of people would use the word hard to describe, but that must have been hard, that part, you know, it must have been difficult. In your telling of it, it was just so easy.
It was easy. It doesn't need to be hard. You just have to love. You know, if the love is there and if it's real, that's all that matters.
And it's really powerful.
And people just need to stop worrying about all this other stuff and just spend a lot more time loving. It's not that hard, and it's well worth it.
A final note. Peggy told me that if her wedding happened today, it wouldn't be a big story at all. And she's probably right. Remember earlier I mentioned that in the late 50s, only 4% of Americans approved of interracial marriage. As of 2021, that number had grown to 94%. I certainly hope you enjoyed this Mobituary. May I ask you to please rate and review our podcast? You can also follow Mobituaries on Facebook and Instagram, and you can follow me on Twitter at Moraka. Hear all new episodes of Mobituaries every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts. And check out Mobituaries' Great Lives Worth Reliving, the New York Times best-selling book, now available in paperback and audiobook. It includes plenty of stories not in the podcast. This episode of Mobituaries was produced by Zoe Marcus and Aaron Schrank. Our team of producers also includes Wilco Martinez-Cachero and me, Mo Rocca. It was edited by Maura Walls and engineered by Josh Hahn, with fact-checking by Naomi Barr. Our production company is Neon Hum Media. Our archival producer is Jamie Benson. Our theme music is written by Daniel Hart. Indispensable support from Craig Swagler, Dustin Gervais, Alan Peng, Reggie Bazile, and everyone at CBS News Radio. Special thanks to Alelia Bundles, Young Kim, Mary Garner McGeehee, Zebulon Maletsky, and Alberto Rabina. Mobituary's senior producer is the unconquerable Aaron Schrank. Executive producers for the series include Steve Razies and Mo Rocca. Mobituaries was created by yours truly. And as always, undying gratitude to Rand Morrison and John Karp for helping breathe life into Mobituaries.
Managing your diabetes just got easier. The powerful new Dexcom G7 lets you see your glucose numbers on your compatible watch and phone without fingersticks. And because Dexcom G7 is the most accurate CGM system, you can be confident in your food, exercise, and medication decisions. And all those decisions can lead to big results, like more time in range and lower A1C. Get started at Dexcom.com.
Dexcom data on file 2023. If your glucose alerts and readings from the G7 do not match symptoms or expectations, use a blood glucose meter to make diabetes treatment decisions. For a list of compatible devices, visit Dexcom.com/compatibility.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Nobody wants to outlive their money, but it happens, especially for women. That's why Gainbridge offers the Parity Flex annuity, designed for women's unique retirement needs, with flexible withdrawals plus a guaranteed lifetime income benefit that keeps paying you even if your account balance is zero. Gainbridge is helping build a better financial future for women. Retirement income you can't outlive is the ultimate flex. Start saving now at Gainbridge.io. Visit Gainbridge.io/ParityFlex for current rates, full product disclosures and disclaimers, and other important information.